Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
From our homes, I'm Kenny Holmes.
Oh, that's so nice. I'm Robert Kraft. Yeah, we're all doing this the modern way.
This is Score, the podcast presented by Spitfire Audio. This is interesting. We're not in the same room. I want to take a quick second to introduce our other guests joining us, our executive producer, Matt Schrader, and composer, Carol.
Hello, hello.
This is weird, guys. I'm looking at a screen with you all in boxes like we're on the Brady Bunch here.
Yeah, it's quite a bit different, but it's going to be an interesting season. It opens up some new possibilities for us, too. Some UK guests that maybe wouldn't be coming to LA. So this is going to be an interesting season. And what a way to kickstart everything with Danny Elfman.
Yeah. Oh, God, I'm so excited. I would like to reassure you and our listeners that I did decide to wear pants for this episode. One of the great advantages of doing...
You know, it wouldn't matter to us. We can't see.
Yeah. We're waist up, man. You could be wearing cargo shorts. You could whatever you want.
I thought I better dress. It's our season premiere. So
yeah.
I was tempted to wear a tuxedo.
And as Matt mentioned, my favorite composer, it's relative. I mean, look, my favorite score is Batman.
yes.
I have a lot of favorite composers, but Batman stands out as it's my number one, and
it was always your favorite. Even when we were doing the documentary, I remember you talking about Batman and how formative that was and how important that was. So you must be excited.
That VHS was so ratty.
The score sounded so terrible by the end of 1,000 plays.
But not only does Danny have Batman under his belt, but Beetlejuice, Nightmare Before Christmas, Edward Scissorhands, so many great ones. Carol, your favorite, Alice in Wonderland.
Yes. Mm. Also, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I love Good Will Hunting.
Good Will Hunting,
oh,
one
yeah.
of my favorites.
Men in Black.
Just beautiful.
Yes.
Oh, you're so,
so
right.
So many.
How about Pee-wee?
Pee-wee, Can't Silver Linings yeah. Playbook, too. That was another good one. So many great ones, and you know, it's rare for Danny to sit down for a long interview like this, so we're
very
lucky.
Rare. This is such a big get for us.
He has Coachella on the calendar this year that got postponed, which kind of opened the door for us to have him on as the season premiere. So we're really, really excited to have Danny on, and we're lucky, I think.
We are lucky.
If you search Danny Elfman, you won't find a 90-minute interview with him on the internet. So
yeah, and I think a lot of the thanks go to our sponsor. It's just wonderful to have Spitfire Audio, the maker of orchestral virtual instruments for film composer, sponsoring Score the podcast.
The best.
It's really is kind of industry standard, I think.
Yeah, if you're a pro in the industry, you've already been using them. But if you're an up-and-comer, aspiring composer, definitely want to check out some of their packages. Of course, Danny Elfman was inspired to be a composer by Bernard Herrmann, which we'll talk about later in the episode. And they have actually a Bernard Herrmann composer toolkit as one of their packages.
That's right.
So actually, after the show today, we're going to play you a little clip from that package so you can hear some of the different sounds to
demo.
Try and elevate your music. And we also want to mention Spitfire's new Composer magazine, which is really cool on their website. They talk to composers like from shows Ozark and Handmaid's
right
Tale.
Right on.
And,
Handmaid's
also,
Tale, one of my favorites. And I think they're also interviewing Justin Hurwitz, who was our guest.
Yeah.
And the Oscar-winning composer of La La Land. So that should be fun.
That's right.
Yep. And most importantly to our listeners, we like to hook it up a little bit. And with the help of Spitfire, we have a deal for you. 20% off your first purchase.
Nice.
And it's good on well over 50 different Spitfire libraries, so you can go
such
online,
a deal
check those out. Just use the promo code SCORE2020, but this is a limited time offer, and you know, podcasts live on, so if you're listening to this now, make sure to check and see if you can use that promo code now, because it's limited. It's not going to last forever.
Hey, Mash Raider, can you tell us what can we expect from Score Season 3? First of all, did you ever expect we'd get to season 3?
I half expected we might get to season three because I'm such a nerd with film composers, as everyone here is.
We are, I'm looking
at through our Zoom chat here while we're recording remotely. But Danny Elfman, what a way to launch this season. And and I know that we have a lot of other people in the works, some UK composers that I'm really excited about that hopefully we'll be able to bring you this
who we never
season.
Could have gotten until we actually had to use
or you know, it's always podcasting. That weird thing where they're flying in for 3 days or 4 days in LA and they have a meeting on days one and two. And then the third day they have a lunch with a friend. And how are we going to squeeze in, you know, even an hour with you know, a composer that we really want to get? It's difficult to do that. But through this technology that we're bringing in now, we can get access to some of those people and be sitting with them in their studios, not in person, but next best thing, and be able to actually chat with them and hear how they're dealing with all of the coronavirus lockdowns and what they're doing, what they're writing, all of these things. So we're going to have a lot of access that I'm really excited about this year, and we'll be able to keep growing the show. So please feel free to all our fans, keep spreading the word. Social media is the easiest way, but share us with a friend. Danny Elfman, this episode, of course. And we're so excited for season three.
If you are going to spread the word, please wear a mask. And I think we also need Composer Carol. We need to find our favorite Cardi B little audio meme.
Coronavirus. I can't do it.
Coronavirus. whenever somebody says it, I want to hear coronavirus.
It's nice to hear a positive spin on this whole thing. The fact
well, I think
that
there's
it
been
opens
so
the
much creativity
it opens
has exploded.
The door, yeah.
We all know what a great creative community our country is, and how online creativity and comedy is just keeps us all afloat. But many of our composers have actually done funny things. I mean, we've had a lot of fun with them. Mm-hmm. I know that one of my favorite composers wrote a song that was super great.
Only Randy Newman can write a song about COVID-19, and it sounds like it belongs in Toy Story 5. Here's a little clip of it. We got a kick out of this.
It might be in Toy Story 5.
Stay away from me.
Get away from me.
Keep your distance, please.
Hey.
Stay away from me. Words of love in times like these.
That's great.
I'm going to be with you 24 hours a day. A lot of people couldn't stand that, but you can. You be with me 24 hours a day. What a lucky man I am.
Oh, love Randy so much.
Man, that's great.
Maybe we can get him on the show. Maybe we can get him to play on the show. Is that a dream come true? I hope so.
Yeah,
maybe we
can have composers play a little bit this season. Since they're in their studio, they'll be dialed in.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they just have instruments hanging on the wall. We can just say, hey, grab that real quick.
Let us know. Social media. Let us know if you're interested. If you want to use more of that this year.
Speaking of recording remotely, we were talking about this a little bit. There's been some articles out there, and even this past weekend on our Quiplash game we played, we were talking with Jeff Russo about this.
We have to acknowledge, I mean, I did win game number two. I just want to shout out.
Okay, all right, let me give a quick backstory for those of us that don't follow our social
handles. I won game three, all right.
We did a live stream, and it was Quiplash. How do you describe it? Like a living room game.
It's like Cards Against Humanity online.
So you get a prompt. It says, you know, name the worst theme for a pinball machine, and everyone says, you know, diapers, and, you know, death and taxes, and you know, everyone comes up with these ideas for certain answers. Then the funniest answer gets voted on by everyone that plays. So you end up with sometimes pretty raunchy answers, but most of our answers were pretty clean in this round. I was a little bit surprised, and then we started to steer into that territory
devolve.
A couple times. But it's on YouTube now. If you want to watch that game that we played, it was the four of us, Jeff Russo, Christopher Lennertz, Pinar Toprak, and Joseph Trapanese. And we had a great time. So if you want to see more of that, let us know.
We learned that Pinar is the raunchiest of everybody.
Absolutely well,
she,
hysterical.
And she won one of the games, didn't she?
Yeah,
did she
did.
Win the first round or second round?
But Jeff Russo also told us while we were getting ready about what it's like for him to record this season of Star Trek.
No, it was Umbrella Academy.
Oh, it was Umbrella Academy. You're right. He's doing Star Trek, but it was Umbrella Academy where he has each player recording, of course, separately in isolation.
Yeah, and there was, of course, Chris Bowers was mentioning that too with his show on Hulu, Mrs. America, about how the show was, I think for him, he had two episodes left to hit the soundstage and record, and then this whole thing happened, and you know they have a deadline to put the show out, so you got to just put your thinking cap on. This is weird though, man. Like nothing's ever happened like this before, ever, for any of our lifetimes.
It really hasn't. I mean, it just in the specific arena of film music, part of the joy of writing the score is getting to hear it performed by an orchestra or a, you know, an ensemble or a polka band or whatever it is, but getting live players into a room. And here, you're suddenly playing the notes, but if you have everybody sitting separately, I think it's just a little bit different. I have never wanted to say it's better or worse. It's just different, and it's something that we're all getting used to. So we'll see.
It definitely has limitations, but it seems like there's also some experimentation that's happening now, and that's pretty cool. So, I mean, even what we were talking about earlier, this opens up some new possibilities for certain things that maybe we couldn't have done before, but now we can.
You're right.
It does also add a lot of time on the back end to put all that stuff together, which – is probably the worst part of it. Like all of this stuff is doable, but to take all of these different recordings and piece them all together in time instead of the group playing together in a room under the same microphones, that seems like the biggest hassle of all of this.
Yeah, and speaking of adding things on the back end, how are all of you doing with your eating at home? Are you kind of keeping things under control, or have you been... I'm trying.
Everyone gained their the COVID-19 yet?
I'm going the other direction. I'm really taking advantage of the time to try and be careful. But I know, Kenny, you've had some anxiety recently when this very exciting event was coming towards us.
Oh, yeah. So, were you anxious eating? Stress eating?
I've been basically like, do you ever see the Nutty Professor when he's dumping the whole jar of M&Ms into his mouth?
That was the week before Danny Elfman.
When I found out we were having Danny on, I got really excited, as you can imagine. Can't wait to talk to him about Batman and all his great scores. But when we put it on the books, it was weeks in advance. And I think just like anything that you're excited or anticipating, you're always worried that something's going to happen or postpone, or especially with these composers being busy. And in fact, one of the other composers we booked this season had a family illness and had to push it back. So every time that I would get a message about Danny Elfman in email or in Slack or whatever we're using to communicate, all I had in my mind was that he's gonna cancel or postpone.
Oh no, this is.
I've been really
news.
Stressed out about this, and we were actually even worried about posting it on social media, like announcing him, because you know he's somebody who's well in demand, and with all of this content they're trying to get out there, like at any point he could get a call for a animated something, write some music, and I'm just so glad and relieved that we're here and we have him and
we got it.
He's on the show. Very excited. And I'm proud of our team, guys. This has been, you know, we started this a couple years ago as a hobby. And look where we're at now. Season premiere of season 3 with Danny Elfman on the show.
And a great sponsor. We really have kind of moved into the future. So I think,
great season
as
ahead.
They say, without further A-D-I-E-U, not A-D-O, adieu, it's adieu.
Adieu.
Without further adieu. Thank you so much. I thought I'd bring a little culture to the party, but we have the great maestro, Danny Elfman, ahead.
Stick around. We will be right back.
Hey, Score fans. I'm just wondering if you have a favorite question you've been dying to ask us. You know, you could send it to us in an email. You send it to scorethemailbox@epiclef.com. That's E-P-I-C-L-E-F-F. Come up with a good question. Kenny or I will do our best to answer it. And if we don't know the answer, we may make one up, you know, just to keep the program rolling. Better yet, you could even record the question yourself and attach that to an email. Include your name and your location, and you just might make an appearance on this season of Score the Podcast.
Hey there, fans of Score the Podcast. I'm David W. Collins, creator and host of The Soundtrack Show for iHeartRadio. Like you, I love Score the Podcast. And The Soundtrack Show is the perfect complement if you're passionate about music for film, TV, even video games and theater. Each week, I do a deep dive into some of the greatest scores of all time, as well as some fan favorites, and talk about why the music moves us from a character and story point of view. We also learn fascinating behind-the-scenes stories and share the history and background that brought each piece of music to life. It doesn't matter if you're a musician or not. Music is a language that we all understand. And through our love of movies like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Back to the Future, or even classics like Casablanca or Psycho, we can gain a deeper appreciation for how composers are speaking to us through music, explaining why we have such a powerful reaction to the images on screen. The Soundtrack Show is available on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Marco Beltrami. You're listening to Score the Podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
Presented by Spitfire Audio, welcome back to the season premiere episode of Score the Podcast. A huge guest. We've been wanting to get this composer on the show since we started. He's an Oscar-nominated composer with some of the greatest film scores. I mean, he's definitely on the Rushmore of film composing. Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, my favorite, Batman, Men in Black, so many great ones. Danny Elfman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on the show, Danny.
Danny, it's fun to even think that you and I get an opportunity to chat. There's so many wonderful histories and intertwining family relationships here. Did you intend on being a rock star with Oingo Boingo, or did you think this is my path to being one of the greatest film composers in cinema history? Is there one of those that was obvious to you, or was it just stumbling forward?
Oh, it was all 100. Well, first off, thank you for that insanely over-complimentary introduction, which I don't deserve.
Accurate.
But it was all stumbling. I didn't even intend to get into music ever when I was young. I didn't have a musical background. I didn't take music lessons. My parents weren't very musical. Now, interestingly, much later, I once found a trumpet in the closet at home when I was a kid, and my mom said, "Oh, your dad played trumpet." And I asked my dad about it. I said, "You played trumpet?" And he goes, "Ah, it was nothing, nothing." He was a school teacher for his entire career, taught elementary school. And I didn't learn till later that he came to California from Kenosha, Wisconsin, to hit it as a big band trumpet player and songwriter, and actually had written songs. He never mentioned it to any of us. And if I tried to bring it up with him, he would just go, "No, no, no, that was nothing. That was nothing." Wouldn't talk about it, had no regrets. And he just made it sound like, "Oh, that was just something that happened for a second, and but wasn't my calling." So I had very little musical background. it was all a series of coincidences, starting with the fact that my parents moved neighborhoods when I started high school. And I started high school, Uni High in West LA, with no friends. And so I started making new friends from scratch. And I ended up falling in with an arty crew by sheer coincidence. And most of them played instruments. One of them was, in fact, already a composer at 16. And this composer, his name is Michael Byron. He's still out there in the East Coast composing. I hope he's well right now in this catastrophe. Haven't talked to him in a while. But he turned me on to The Rite of Spring and then more Stravinsky. And it really turned my world upside down. I literally threw away over the next 2 years almost all of my albums. I mean, I overreacted. I wish I had them back now. But that was typical for me. I learned. Yeah. One of this group was a percussionist, the drummer, who ended up becoming now percussionist with San Francisco Symphony. And he was the crazy one, you know, like as drummers tend to be. So I had a composer, a drummer, another guy was a bass player, and my own girlfriend was not really a musician, but she was an artist and she played some bass. She went on to found Sonic Youth.
Oh, wow.
So, Kim. Yes. And so, it was an arty group and it turned my perspective completely around.
Was there a moment that you had to pick an instrument to kind of launch into the group? I mean,
No, it wasn't into the group. It was out of the group because it was my last year in high school and I didn't graduate with the group. I left 6 months early. So I technically got a diploma, although I sometimes say I'm a high school dropout because I didn't complete my last year and I wanted out so bad, so quick. And, but I knew I was going to travel around the world. That's what I wanted to do. And, I picked up violin and I owe that to the fact that Kim Gordon and myself and a couple others used to frequently go to an Indian restaurant in Venice. And that's where I lived in the early days. And they played a lot of Django Reinhardt.
Oh, Stefan Grappelli time.
Yeah. And Stefan Grappelli became my, it's like, wow, I'd love to play jazz violin like that. So I went off on this trip and I brought it was crazy because I had this huge backpack and on the backpack was a violin in a canvas case. And I carried it for a year through Africa and kind of taught myself violin. And then more coincidences continued to happen. Now, I have to say that by the time I got to high school, I was a film fan. And I was also a fan of some film music because Bernard Herrmann connected with me when I was about 12 or 13. And I started noticing his name every film that he was on, I knew was going to be something special. And I grew up in the era of the Bernard Herrmann science fiction fantasies. Jason and the Argonaut, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, you know, and when I would see his name with Harryhausen, it's like, this is going to be my favorite movie this year. And it would be. The HH, Harryhausen-Herrmann combination was magic for me. So now I'm in high school. I'm hanging out with an arty group. I'm going to the movies at least three times a week because those are the days where the retrospective houses played the Fox Venice and the New Art for $1, maybe $2. You'd see a different movie every night of the week. And we didn't have video, of course, and DVDs. So I was soaking up cinema. And it was a great period to be soaking up cinema because in 1 week at the Fox Venice, you'd be seeing Kurosawa with Polanski, with Russ Meyers, with Truffaut, with Roger Corman. It was all
so rich.
Mixed up. It was so rich, and I didn't realize it at the time that those high school years, I was getting this great education. And, of course, a lot of Alfred Hitchcock. And in the Hitchcock, amazingly, I rediscovered my childhood infatuation with Herrmann. Because Herrmann, at that point, when I was young, did not include Hitchcock movies because I had never seen one. And the first Hitchcock movie that came out as a kid that I was like, oh, I got to see this, was the first and only movie I was forbidden to see, which was Psycho. Now, in the 60s, my mother had no idea what I was going to the movies to see. They didn't accompany us. I went every weekend, Baldwin Hills Movie Theater. I never saw an adult in that theater. It was just hundreds of kids converging, and they'd play two films. And, you know, that was my early years, but I never a Hitchcock film, because Psycho comes out and there's this kind of press about psychosexual thing. And my mom says, "Oh no." I go, "What is this word? No, I've never heard it before for a movie." It just had never been in the vocabulary. There was never even a, "What are you going to go see this week?" I, you know, she did ask, I go, "Oh, it's The Head That Wouldn't Die." And, you know,
The Man with Two Brains.
Well, that makes you want to go see it even more at that point, yeah, as a kid, too.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It kind of was maddening. I'd never been denied access to a film. And thank God we didn't have ratings and all that stuff back then, because I wouldn't have been able to see two-thirds of the stuff that I saw when I was a kid, which was gory as hell. And I'm so grateful that I was able to see it nonetheless. But Hitchcock, Psycho, I couldn't see it. So the first Hitchcock movie I saw was The Birds, which, has no score.
Yeah.
And so it really wasn't until high school later that suddenly I'm going, oh my God, North by Northwest, Psycho, Vertigo. It's like Citizen Kane. It's like I'm going back through the entire now history of Herman that I saw as a fantasy composer. And all this other sides of him. And so that really made me a fan. So I
never
kind of
actually knew. Did you meet him?
Oh, no. By the time, 1985, when I did my first film, I had no way of accessing Herman or any of that. You know, it's like it never occurred to me that I would ever be scoring a film until Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Because I just cut from you watching those movies to you scoring movies, and there's a kind of huge gap in there. What happens to make that transformation?
I actually wanted to ask you before we go too far ahead, did you ever circle back with your dad about that trumpet once you started getting into music? Did you guys ever jam? Did you find a bond there at all?
No, he never played for me ever. He would just like, "Oh, no, I don't play anymore." He would just laugh. He would just laugh it off.
I mean, there is something really incredible about the genetic relationship of you not growing up in a musical household or taking lessons and ending up this complete and magnificent musician. That is unorthodox, to say the least.
Well, it's unorthodox, and I try to advise when I do talk with students, I say, do not do what I have done, because my life has been a series of crazy accidents, including becoming a performer, which I'd never intended to do, getting into music, which I never intended to do. If you'd have asked me in the 11th grade what I wanted to do with my life, I would have said, maybe at that point, I might have said film instead of biology. I might have switched, but it would have been an editor, maybe a cinematographer. That's where my mind was. Maybe someday I'd be a director, but an editor, cinematographer, these things like seem like sensible ways to try to start studying film. And when I went and traveled for a year, it was my intention to come back and go to school and study film. I never got the chance. More accidents happened along the way.
I'm curious what, I mean, these some are good accidents. Great stories. Yeah. I mean, the accidents, first of all, I thought you were going to say when you talk to students, you know, it's interesting you say you advise them not to do it the way that you did. But the other part of it is there's this kind of assumption these days, particularly with all the film schools and music departments, that there's a tried and true path. And there's not one composer who doesn't say it was accident. It was
right
karma.
Place, right time. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yours
yes
is
no.
More extreme in some ways.
I would agree. Yes. Because I would argue with the student, you really got to study and learn what it is you do and then wait for that accident. Because the accident isn't I became a composer. The accident is I got a lucky break.
Right.
Everybody will have a story of a lucky break, meaning being at the right place at the right time, of course.
But you got to be ready for it. Yeah.
But you got to be ready for it. And I'm a rare case of somebody who wasn't ready, but I was an eager and quick learner, and I soaked it up really aggressively. So I came to film music as a fan, and I've often described it like, imagine Jack Nicholson is sitting courtside at a Laker game, which we've seen on the screen for decades and decades. He's like a fan of the game. Imagine somebody gets injured on the court and they throw the ball to Jack and say, you're in. It's kind of like that's what it felt like when I got thrown Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It was like, okay, get on the court. You're in. And
did you have a stomach ache at that moment of I can't do this or this is beyond me? Or was it, oh, let's just take a shot?
Well, I mean, I got a call to meet with Tim Burton on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and I was in Oingo Boingo at the time. So it already, I was in a rock band, and I assumed it was about a song for the movie. And he says to me, no, I'd like you to do the score. And it's like, I literally, my words to him was, why me? And he was like, well, I don't know. I've been to Boingo concerts, and I just think you could do it. Now,
nice.
There's another layer behind that, which I wasn't aware of, which was Paul Rubens. When I got the call to, you know, meet about Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I knew who Pee-wee was immediately because I'd seen Paul's work for years. I used to go to the Groundlings in Los Angeles, which was an improv comedy group. And I saw Paul do Pee-wee when Pee-wee was just one of several characters that he did. But it brought down the house every night. So by the time Pee-wee's Big Adventure came along, I was like, ah, great, a Pee-wee movie. But what I didn't know is that this goes back to those crazy intertwining coincidences. When I got back from my year in Africa, which wasn't around the world like I'd planned, that ended up just taking a year to cross the continent, I didn't quite understand looking at a map what it meant to start in Mauritania and go down the coast and cross over through Africa and end up on the East Coast.
Yeah.
It was like close to a year trip.
Right.
And in the meantime, before that trip started, I stopped in and visit my brother in Paris. More coincidences. My brother was a conga drummer. He had gone to Toronto when I was 16. I was in Europe. My father had a minor heart attack when he was in Toronto. My brother flew there to be with them. I didn't even know about it. They didn't tell me until I got home. They didn't want to worry me. And he met on the streets a theatrical troupe called Le Grand Magic Circus from Paris that was there for a festival. And he got some congas and he jammed with them. And they said, come to Paris and play with us. So now I go to Paris, it's 3 years later, and he's playing conga drums with Le Grand Magic Circus. I got this violin on my back. I'm practicing one day. You know, I stayed with him for a couple of weeks before heading off to Morocco. And at least that was the plan at that moment. And the director comes in while I'm playing, and I come out, and he goes, hey, he called me Little Red. My brother was Big Red, and I was Little Red. You should come play with us. I go, I've been playing for 5 months. I don't play. He goes, yeah, you're good enough. And I decided, what the fuck? And I just went on and played with Le Grand Magic Circus. So I got performing for the first time in my life.
Yeah. Did you sing or just play?
Just play. And now I get back a year later, very ill from West Africa, and my brother had started the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. He left Le Grand Magic Circus. He came home with his French wife, Marie Pascal, and started this troupe based somewhat on Le Grand Magic Circus. Hmm. And I was immediately appointed musical director.
Nice.
Because he used to hear me goof around on stuff, and he just decided, oh, you can do this. So I became the musical director of a street theater troupe, literally, that we passed the hat for years. We
just fantastic. Played.
And in those years, I learned to write music. I learned to notate, transcribe. Because when I started with the Mystic Knights, I wanted to make it more musical. So I started a thing. Everybody who came in the troupe had to play at least three instruments. And eventually, after 3-4 years, there's 12 of us. And we're a brass band, we're a string band, and we're a percussion band.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we, at that point, I was absolutely infatuated with music pre-1938. And so in the 70s now, I'm a young man in Los Angeles, I wouldn't listen to anything written after 1938. I said, that's my cutoff. And I started wanting to do Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway arrangements with the Mystic Knights. And I had to learn to transcribe.
Amazing. It's and just so fabulous.
I taught myself to write listening. It started with Duke Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy. I'll not forget
fabulous.
It.
Fabulous, yeah.
Because the hard part there is getting the piano solo right. Mm. And Duke's style was interesting, and I had to really listen. In those days, you had to drop a needle over and over on a record. There was no like scrubbing through digital recordings. And I learned that I had a good ear. So now in the late 70s, my brother leaves the Mystic Knights to go off and do a movie called Forbidden Zone. And he wants me and the Mystic Knights to do the music. So with the Mystic Knights, I do a kind of a score. It wasn't really like a synchronized score, but it was a score. Now, unbeknownst to me, and this is where it all comes together, Paul Rubens was a big fan. And Paul Rubens, and Paul told me this only not that long ago, he said, when I came home from Forbidden Zone, I said, if I ever do a movie, I'm hiring that guy to do my music.
What?
Yeah. So now it's 1985. Years later, I'm in a rock band. I already thought all that work I'd put into learning to transcribe and to notate was wasted time and effort. Because, you know, I'm in a rock band. You don't write music down.
It's head charts.
Yeah. It's just like, here's the chords. Here's the melody. You sing it, then you're off. It's like there's no writing anything down.
You were filling up this toolbox for the future that you weren't aware of. It's pretty crazy.
I was filling up a toolbox for the future that I was totally unaware of. I actually was a point where I was like, oh, those wasted years. And then I get called to do Pee Wee's Big Adventure. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. How do you do that? And there was a beat you had asked, like where my stomach hurt. When I first got the call, my manager, I said, tell him I can't do it. And I met with him. I did a demo. I made a tape on a 4-track, sent him a cassette. And he goes, why? I go, because I don't know how to score a film. He goes, you call him and tell him. I spent a week negotiating this deal. You call him if you want. And I thought about picking up the phone. But the thing that served me best in life at that moment, at that particular juncture, was the fact that Oingo Boingo wasn't a punk band, but I was totally punked out in my own way. It's like I didn't give a fuck about anybody, what anybody thought about what we did. I was totally confrontative on stage. I loved getting into scuffles on the floor. I mean, it was just part of my life. It just matched my energy level. I was too old. You know, when I started Oingo Boingo, I said, we can't be a punk band. I'm old. I'm an old man. I'm 28, 27. It's like punks are 17. You know, it's like, okay, so I'm an old man. I'll do my own thing, starting a ska group. But my head was in that space. And so when I got that job, it was just kind of like, literally, I thought about it and I said, fuck it. I don't care. They'll throw out the score, and if they don't like it, they can go fuck themselves. I mean, that was my mindset, and that was a perfect mindset because I didn't think about it. It was just like, here's an open door, go. It was just that simple.
I think that it's actually, when I was reading about some of your other work, occasionally you've mentioned with...
There it is.
Oh, of course, with Pee Wee. I think... I read that with The Simpsons, there was a similar, you know, this won't go, it's not important, I'll just have fun with it. What you're really saying is that often when you throw out your own expectations or any external pressure, and you say, I'm just going to do this for the love of it or for the fun of it, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You've actually allowed yourself huge creative freedom. I mean, the remarkable part about it is that Pee Wee score, I was listening to it this weekend, it holds up. It holds up as whatever your mindset was, you nailed it. And it's also referential. It's funny you say 1938 to film music from eras before that.
Well, yeah. I mean, at that point, I was referential to the 60s, to Nina Rota.
Of course.
When I first saw Pee-wee, the opening scene of him on a bicycle in a bicycle race, I said, this feels like a weird European comedy, like a wacky early European comedy. It doesn't feel like an American contemporary comedy. And that goes back to being at the right place at the right time. In the 80s, film comedies musically were in a weird place. There wasn't a lot happening. People didn't know quite what to do with music. Comedy scores tend to either be kind of classical based or pop, like kind of pop based or sometimes jazzy, but more like kind of pop music.
I think you're right. I think it was sort of that Faltermeyer, you know, thinking of 80s things. They were trying to sound cool by putting synth and sequenced drums, and comedy was in a little bit of a betwixt and between.
It was betwixt and between. And so Pee-wee just happened to come along at exactly the right moment. I didn't care if the studio, Warner Brothers, liked the score because I figured they were going to throw it out. I mean, I went in already figuring Tim Burton loves it. That's all that matters. He's the only one I'm playing music for. And the studio will hear it. They'll throw it out and they'll hire a real composer. So I went in with that mindset and I said, that's fine. I'll get a good experience out of it. I loved writing the score. And I'll tell you, the first moment when I was in front of the orchestra, hearing that first cue played back, that was a deep impression. I'd never been in front of an orchestra before. I'd never even really heard an orchestra play. I mean, I've been to a few concerts as a kid.
Did you conduct it?
Oh, no. Are you kidding? I mean, me conducting would be the biggest joke. Even now, I never conduct, and I will never conduct.
I didn't realize that till one of the first things we did together, and you sat in the control room, which I thought made so much sense. But I think I was used to the composer doubling up, and it never occurred to me, well, wait a minute. It's actually more important to sit next to the director.
Absolutely. It's the only way I could conceive. Is like, first off, I want to hear the music through speakers. I don't want to hear it in the room. It sounds much better in the room, but it's not what you're going to hear in the theater. And a film score is designed to play through speakers. It's not designed to play in a concert. So I want to hear it like I'm going to hear it in a theater, which is a different balance than sitting in the room. So that's first thing.
Did you know how to spot a film? I mean, there's certain kind of like essential things that film composers know that it sounds like in the beginning. I wonder, did you know how to spot a film, and did you record at Warner Brothers, and were there like executives in the room? I mean, it's just to have in retrospect, look back and say, here's a guy that's creating this work that if anybody tapped him on the shoulder and asked him like all these baseline questions, he'd say, I actually haven't done it that way. Did you spot with Tim Burton for Pee-wee?
Yeah, I spotted. I had a really good music editor. His name is Bob Bademy. And
the best.
And he kind of like, it was right at the beginning of the era where he said you could use a click book. And they were still using click books. Knudsen click book. So you time the space. I go, no, I'm not going to do that. And so it was just start here, end here, start here, end here. And I figured out how to take it and find a click with I would just get a click from a Roland drum machine, just play different clicks. Mm. And I'd find the tempo that felt right for the scene. And
perfect.
That's what I would write. And what I learned on Pee-wee was that if you find the right tempo for a scene, it's easy.
Yeah.
Making things hit is easy. It's not nearly as hard as I thought it was. If you find the editor's internal tempo.
Yes.
And that's what I learned there, that a good editor will have a pace that he may or may not even be aware of. And if you find that tempo, that is where the editor is coming from, things tend to just fall in line without that much difficulty. And that was like the great lesson that, you know, Bob taught me how to spot and how to like start a cue and get it rolling. Had very primitive tools at that point. Like I said, just a Roland drum machine, a, you know, 707 or what was that? I can't even remember which.
Yeah. 808
drum machine it was. 808 and a few synthesizers.
Did you demo for Tim or the studio?
Yeah, I mean, I had the demo for Tim, and that was hard because at Pee Wee's Big Adventure, me playing the breakfast machine Pee Wee's Big Adventure on piano for Tim. If you've ever seen Shine with Jeffrey Rush,
of course,
playing Rachmaninoff, yeah. I mean, the pianist playing Rachmaninoff on the piano and the sweat pouring down, that was me trying to play Pee Wee's Big Adventure for Tim. And I vowed at that moment, I'll never do this again in my life. So it was after Pee Wee where I was trying to play through stuff on the piano. And I'm so not a pianist. The only instrument I had any experience with at that point was a little bit of violin. And violin wasn't going to help me show. You know, yeah. You have to play it on a keyboard.
You said in a previous interview that Batman was your most difficult time with a score, because partly because you had to present to producers, the producers didn't want you. But why was the Batman thing so difficult?
Yeah, I mean, I had 9 films under my belt. That's the only reason I was able to do Batman, because every film I did, I would try to get 1 or 2 films a year for those early years because I wanted to learn. I was really hungry. And so Tim used to joke that Pee-wee was 1, Beetlejuice was 5, and Batman was 10. And he goes, you're doing 4 films between each of mine. I go, exactly. That's what I need to do. But I was also writing and touring and producing for Oingo Boingo. So they were crazy years. I remember getting a couple of movies where I would go to the band and go, I'll split my fee with you. I'll give you half my fee. I'll keep half. So I'm buying the time to take off a month and score this film from Oingo Boingo. And
so Oingo Boingo was still going during Batman.
Oh yeah. Ten years.
You're still in a band.
I did both. Yeah. 85 to 95. I'm still in the band. I'm writing, producing, touring, and I'm trying to get in 2 scores a year if I can.
My goodness.
How many scores a year would you say you do in, I don't know if 2020 is representative, what would be the most number of scores you've written in a year? I mean, these are all the questions I've always wanted to ask, so they're random.
Well, I mean, for me, that would be 4 would be the most that's possible, really,
yeah.
Because I don't use a crew.
Yeah.
And sure. I can't really do multiple films at the same time. And a film tends to be 6 weeks to 3 months or more. So 4 films potentially takes up the better part of a year.
Yeah.
Or potentially a whole year.
Yeah.
And
you run into composers that overbook and they end up with 2 at once, because I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but occasionally in show business, films go a little longer than told you.
Yeah, that I've had them. I look at them as icebergs. You know, you get them set up, but sometimes they start floating and suddenly one crashes into the other. And occasionally, once or twice, one actually passes the other one up. And so things happen and I've had them overlap, but I work hard at not having as little overlap as possible because it is maddening for me.
I wonder, did the demo process change for you? You played piano on that breakfast scene, which is one of my favorites. But
yeah, in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I played piano. But believe me, by the time Back to School came along, already I was trying to figure out a way to play into like a primitive sequencer and play back. So I could play. What I learned is that the only way I can do this is to play slowly and then play it back at tempo.
Right. And what I wondered is, you know, it became so accepted that you'd go to the composer's studio with the producer and the director and the executives, and the composer would hit the space bar and play an entire, completely synthesized, mocked up cue.
But is that's that how something we do it now.
And is that something that you had to accommodate and evolve to, or will people say it's Danny Elfman, just play me, you know, the right hand of the piano?
No, not at all. I mean, that was part of the evolution of those early years. Between 85 and 90 was exactly the years of MIDI really taking off. I had the first Mac, and for me, it was incredible to be able to like synchronize a digital performer in a Macintosh and start to lay multiple tracks in. So by the time I got to Beetlejuice, which was Tim's second film, but my fifth film, I was mocking everything up already. Now, the mock-ups didn't sound good, but it was all mocked up. By the time I got to Batman, I knew how to like fully render. But, you know, to answer an earlier question, I didn't have producers and executives coming in early on. And that was the beautiful thing about those first films. Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice. It was really just him and I. Edward Scissorhands was like that. Nightmare Before Christmas. Batman was the only exception where I suddenly had to like, wow, I have to play for people. Yeah. Do, you know, what we call a dog and pony show for everybody. And that is really nerve-wracking. But the and Pee-wee... You know, there's something great about being on a movie that's below the radar of most people. It's like, oh, yeah, they're doing that Pee-wee movie. We're not worried. Yeah. Beetlejuice, what the hell is that? We're not worried. Batman, we're worried. So suddenly...
On all levels, right? I mean, that was a big gamble for many, the studio, for everybody, to try and change what people expected of Batman.
It was totally understandable that they were very nervous about me. Tim wanted me on the show, but John Peters, the producer, was not keen at all about having me. The studio, I think they felt like, yeah, Danny's fine for the comedies, but we need a real composer. Mm. And I get it. I mean, I would have thought the same way. So I'm not looking at how they were thinking with any kind of like, those bastards, it was a sensible thing for them to be worried about me. And John wanted, the first meeting we had, you know, he's very pop oriented. So there's a great time when I was walking through Gotham City, Tim flew me out there and I met John, and his original idea was that Michael Jackson would write the Batman theme. George Michaels would write the love theme and Prince would write the Joker theme. And he's telling me about this. And Bob is kind of positioning himself between us as we're walking because he knows we're both hot-blooded guys. Hmm. And we'd already just talked in his office about boxing because he says, you know, he's the first thing he said to me, so I hear you box. I go, no, I just train. I don't actually box. And he was really interested. And he showed me how to do a sucker punch in his office. And I still know how to do a sucker punch.
I don't. So you're going to have to show me at some point.
Thanks to John. And so he's describing this, and Bob's moving between us because I think he sees on my face, it's like, this isn't going well. And so I was like, oh, I don't really understand what I'd be doing in here. And then it came down to like, you know what? We want you to co-write a score with Prince. Hmm. And I had to say, I love Prince. I respect Prince, but I'm not co-writing a score with them because I don't want to do a pop score. I already know what this score is. I already knew the score. I had it in my head. And I knew that if I co-wrote Being Me Nobody with somebody like Prince, I would be essentially orchestrating Prince's music.
Yeah.
Because I know how it works. And no disrespect to Prince, but I was going to be a glorified orchestrator. And I didn't have the gravitas at that point to be able to say, okay, you do this part and I'll do this part and let's approach it as equals or anything like that.
Did
you know?
Tim tell you where songs would go and where score would go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the songs were in the film.
Yeah.
There was like two songs on camera.
Yeah.
And it's like that was never an issue. I mean, I've had that actually on a number of films where,
sure,
okay, you're spotting the film. This is spotted for a song. they've even shot to a song. You know,
Elliot Smith with Goodwill. There was so
absolutely
many.
And it was they even knew what pieces of music, and it wasn't like a mystery as it often is,
yeah,
as with Elliot in Goodwill Hunting. But they didn't want me on the movie, and I had to like temporarily leave the film. And
I never knew.
Yep, for a short time, I had to back off, and I said, let Prince do his thing. And I spent the most miserable month of my life, honestly.
Shoot.
I felt like I'd walked away from this great opportunity. Now, I may have started with a fuck-all attitude on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but now 10 films later, I'm enjoying it. I really want it. I want more of it. I'm like, I'm hooked.
Yeah.
And I felt like I just threw my career away.
Oh.
But and looking back, that was probably the best decision you ever made for that, right?
I was, but you know, there are moments like this, there's no answers. There's two doors and you have to walk through one of them.
It was a brave move.
And there's many doors I look back on in my past where I walked through the wrong door here. But this wasn't one of those moments, fortunately, because about a month later, I got a call from Tim saying, would you come back to London? Let's talk.
And had you played him that theme? Had he heard it, or was that still to come?
I think at that point I had, but I think Tim was also trying to navigate the waters here, like what to do and how, and he was real interested in, you know, Prince and having him involved with the film, but he didn't have a lot of power yet at that moment either. So he wasn't in a position to go, no, this is what I want. He couldn't do that. It had to happen organically.
Yeah.
Prince went and wrote a bunch of music. They played it, and I got the call.
Oh, that's so nice. And it's such an epic score.
Oh, my God.
And also, it's interesting to think, particularly hearing the backstory, that now mm-hmm. we have Pee-wee, which is one kind of score, Beetlejuice, which is certainly one kind of score, and then Batman sets a whole template for a generation of a kind of movie score, a kind of sound that I can understand, having been a film executive, exactly what you said. The guy who does Pee-wee is going to do Batman. You know, what?
Right.
It just, it
that's like
compute.
The equivalent now of like you're doing a $200 million film and you're hiring the guy who did like some quirky comedy and going, whoa, wait a minute. That was a interesting, but this is a $200 million movie. Now, Batman wasn't $200 million, but it was about equivalent then to like a $150 million movie. And it was a very risky thing. So I had to fight for that. I had to suffer for it. But the beauty of Pee-wee and Beetlejuice and Batman and still to come, Edward Scissorhands and The Nightmare Before Christmas, was that there was no templates to work with. Nothing. And that now, in hindsight, is heaven, because it almost never happens to me anymore, where you get a movie where there's virtually no template. They can't temp the movie. They don't temp it because there's
it's
nothing.
It's so interesting. You're so right. There's not one of those five that's a genre movie. Here's what we're going to do. We're making a very by-the-numbers movie, and the score is clear, and the aesthetic of the score is just mimic these other 10 pictures. When you think about that, I mean, Nightmare, which I, of course, I've seen it and I've seen you perform it at the Hollywood Bowl.
We both went to the Bowl live. That was great.
I'll tell you one thing that leaped out at Nightmare to me beyond everything else that leaped out. Your singing is so great. It made me think, has anybody approached Danny to do Broadway? I mean, you could be on stage singing. It's not only in tune, which is a big favorite of mine for a singer, but
on rare occasions.
At what point did Tim or how did the decision get made that you were going to play Jack Skellington?
Yeah, that was a slow one because I was writing, you know, I really, Nightmare was a weird project. Again, there's no template.
None.
Neither Tim or I knew how do you begin an animated musical. And all I know knew musically, which Tim was in agreement with me, fortunately, was what we didn't want it to sound like. So we don't want it to sound like a Broadway musical or a Disney musical. Other than that, what is it? No idea. So, but now I'm used to this because Edward and Batman, I mean, again, there was nothing. When I did Batman, the only score that was like the action score that would have been relevant would have been Superman, John Williams' Superman. We knew we don't want it to sound like Superman. What do we want it to sound like? No idea. Beetlejuice, no idea. Nightmare Before Christmas, Edward Scissorhands, really no idea. I mean, Tim wouldn't even tempt the movie for preview because he just couldn't find music to tempt it with. For Nightmare, it's like, all right, we don't really have a script. You have an outline. You have these great drawings. You have an animator with a studio set up ready to go. Let's just start writing songs. Let's just start doing songs. And he would come over every 3 days and show me drawings and tell me the story. And I'd go, I get it. Jack is feeling forlorn. He's the king of Pumpkin Town. He doesn't want the throne. He wants something else. And I get the song in my head. So I'd shoo him out the door and I'd go write Jack's Lament. 3 days later, play him a demo. Next song, Jack's lost in the forest. He comes across these three doors. He gets sucked down. He sees Christmas Town. He sees this and this. And I'm going, I get it. I get it. I get it. I write, what's this? I spent about 3 days per song, demoed them up. And after a month, we got 10 songs. It's like, all right, we don't know how to do a musical, but we got 10 songs. And we're telling as much of the story in the music as we can, because there wasn't really anything else to go with at that point. But the thing is it was this great luxury of nobody at Disney was trying to move us one direction or another, because they were like, we don't know what the hell this thing is. This is not Aladdin. This is not Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. This is not the Little Mermaid. Let's let them do their thing, because this is clearly another world. And they let us do our thing. I mean, there was no involvement in terms of approvals or needing to hear where it was going or what was happening. And
what a dream.
What a dream.
You actually said also it's two things of all difficult genres in movie world. You said how to do nobody, you know, had told us how to do an animated musical. You know, you could divide that. Animated films are virtually impossible to get right and musically incredibly challenging. And a musical is a science that very few people understand. And you're going to now do an animated musical from scratch.
I mean, that doesn't sound like a Disney musical.
These are just the matter.
And it's also like stop motion, which adds probably another layer that was just different. Everything about it was.
Yeah, but Tim and I both loved stop motion. I mean, Tim did stop motion. And of course, you know, I grew up on Harryhausen, so I loved stop motion. I couldn't have been more pleased about that. And Henry did a magnificent job. But just to answer your question, when did I know I was going to sing it? At the end of that period, Tim and I go in the studio. And I have all the instrumental tracks. And I laid vocals down for the entire musical, with the exception of Sally's song, which meant I did Jack's part, the big voices, the little voices, you know, all the group stuff. And we just spent one long evening recording demos for everything, because these demos were going to go to Henry, and Henry was going to begin animating. And at the end of that session, I was slowly becoming more apparent as I was singing all these songs for Jack that I hadn't started out thinking it was for me. But by the end, I was getting this mindset that, you know, if another singer gets this part, he really better watch out for like mysterious accidents, like a piano falling out of a window, you know, a poison, cyanide somehow getting in a cup of tea. It's like these things will become extremely possible for this person.
You think Tim secretly anticipated that happening, or did it all just fall into place?
I couldn't answer that.
He was an Oingo Boingo fan. He'd heard you. I wonder.
At the end of that session, I go up to him. I go, you know, Tim, I don't know how to say this, but Jack's, these songs, And he goes, Danny, don't worry. You're doing it.
I just wonder, life has been saved.
Somebody, some talented singer's life is just saved.
You are the pumpkin.
Forgive me for not knowing. Have you sung another movie since Nightmare? Have you sung an entire score?
No. I mean, I did a song in Corpse Bride for Tim called Remains of the Day that was really fun. And I did hundreds of voices for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for all the songs for those.
Your voice in the beginning of The Simpsons? I saw that somewhere.
That the smartest accident I ever made in my life.
Oh, that's right, because of SAG-AFTRA.
Yeah, being at Fox, and we're doing the score just like a week after I wrote it for The Simpsons. And it's like it starts with those, The Simpsons. And I was going to hire three singers. And I said, I'll do one of them. And, you know, just put three of us in there. Why not? And I got my SAG card for that.
Oh, that's so great. I want to go back to Scissorhands for a minute, because you, not only was it no template, but when you mentioned the singing, I don't know if you're a singer in the choir or you found a choir. Was there a moment where you thought, I know what we'll do for this ice dance? We'll do a choir sound. I mean, it just feels...
Well, no, that was part of the creation.
In retrospect, you just think it's obvious, but there had to be a moment where it wasn't obvious.
Well, it's when I was writing it. I really, you know, what were my inspirations for Edward? I mean, it would have been Tchaikovsky. It would have been... you know, there's the use of the celeste and choir. It's going to be Tchaikovsky, really. I'm trying to think of if I'd even heard Gabriel Fauré at that point, because Fauré became the Requiem, a huge piece for me. And it was right around that time. So I think that had something to do with it. You know, it was interesting. When I heard Fauré's Requiem, it was a recording that had a boy rather than a soprano singing the part. And then later I found other recordings, and it was sopranos singing. And I said, they're wrong. They're all wrong. And I remember somebody saying, well, it was written for a soprano. You just happened to hear it. And then I did more research, and I determined it may be correct or not, that it was in fact written for a boy's voice. Hmm. And it's a totally different piece. And I really just became enamored with the simple style of singing that you can get from a boy that you can't get from an operatic soprano. And even still now, there are opera pieces that I hear that I can't listen to when they're sung by the opera singer that it's supposed to be, but I can hear it sung simply by a non-operatic singer. I like the sound of choir and simple singing, non-emotional, highly techniqued singing. And the children's choir and or the boys' choir really became the perfect sound, because it's really pure, but it doesn't have that highly techniqued feel to it that the adults tend to get.
Was it an actual choir, or was it session singers?
Oh, no. It was a boys' choir we found through... the reason I know this is because the choir came in with the... some nuns and their choir teacher, who was also part of the congregation. And I had my first shrunken head in the studio with us. His name was Uncle Billy. I now have six shrunken heads, but that was the first. And Tim was like, hide Uncle Billy, hide Uncle Billy. We don't want the nuns to see this shrunken head sitting in the control room. So we take Uncle Billy and we hide him down beneath, and Tim would joke the entire recording, Uncle Billy's voice, like, Danny, why don't you want the boys to see me?
Oh, yeah.
Is it something I did? Are you ashamed of me? And Tim would do Uncle Billy, sad voice coming from this drawer, I mean, a cabinet in the studio where he was hidden from the children.
I think it's interesting to even hear you talk about Tim saying something for this reason. I had an incredible experience with you and Tim, which I'm sure for you is not even anywhere in your memory bank, but for me was stunning. I witnessed something that I'd never seen before. And to hear you say Tim making those jokes, I didn't even know that Tim spoke in a studio for this reason. We're doing Planet of the Apes. You've just recorded one of the most magnificent cues in the movie. It's huge. It's massive. It's probably 7 minutes long. It's drums and horns and strings, and it's a huge action cue. And it finishes, and I'm about to high-five everybody in the room, like, boy, did we just nail it. We knocked it in the head. Danny, you just crushed it with that cue. You looked at Tim. You're both sitting at the console. I'm standing sort of between you and behind you. You look at Tim. Tim sort of looks at you, but sort of doesn't look at you. And you say these words, I know, I'll fix it. And I stood there saying, did I just miss some kind of Zen, nonverbal, cosmic communication between two collaborators that I was stunned. Tim did not open his mouth. You did not say there was something wrong in the queue. I thought we were done. And you scribbled something and you said something to the engineer and you walked out on the stand and you came back and you played the queue slightly differently, equally brilliantly. And to this day, I wanted to ask, and here's that moment. A, do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Or is that what often happened, which is you and Tim had something going on that no one else in the room could know, and you would look at him after a fabulous run through and say, I'll fix it. I know. What was it? What did you do wrong in that cue?
I have no idea specifically what it was, but that happened many times, as you're saying right now. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And that's one of the many reasons I can only sit in the control room during a film score, because I want to read the director's body language. You know, directors often tell you a lot by just how they're listening. And with Tim, I got to know there's certain things that can catch him in a certain way, you know, like a certain thing can jump out and catch his ear. And I could see him listening, and I can hear just at the moment where, okay, it's this right here. It's something about the way the strings are happening or something in the brass.
Right.
There's something that sounds a little too some line against another line in a way. You know, Tim has a difficult time with dissonance.
Full stop. Here are these scores that have these incredibly interesting, I mean, even the Batman theme, almost dissonant. Boo-doo-boo. You know that kind of...
Almost.
So but, to hear that Tim has trouble with dissonance, does he realize he's with a composer that plays with consonants and dissonance on a very narrow ledge?
But I have to, with Tim, with all directors, you find where their tolerance are to things. You know, everybody's different. With Tim, that's where his tolerance level is going to be. It's like with dissonance, you can make a rub in a certain way, but beyond a certain point, he's going to hear it as an error or something that grates him and takes him out of the melody. It takes him out of the moment. And so I began to learn where that's happening and try to be sensitive to it. But sometimes when we're playing, it could have been a number of things. It could have been something playing too big or too effusively, or it could have been as simple as a trumpet leading too much where I knew that it shouldn't. It could be any number of things. But I'm watching him and I'm feeling this moment and I go, I know exactly what it is. And so it finishes, and I knew just where it happened, and I can hear what was happening in the music at that moment and go, this is the thing that was catching his ear. Let me fix it before we even go any further. And I would say most of the time I could identify it before he really even needs to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, occasionally he'll hear something, then bring it to my attention. But most, especially in the early performances, you know, the first couple of times, I'll hear stuff say, oh, that won't fly. No, I'll have to control that line. No, I got to bring this out. okay, that brass thing is just never going to go. That's I got to really smooth that out, or do this to it, or do that to it, or take out some dissonance that I snuck in there, and it's just not going to work.
It's so subtle, and I just...
That's the relationship that composers dream of. Do you ever think about like the fact that you didn't have to weed through seven directors to find your match with Tim Burton? It seems like you guys are a dream come true for filmmaking, and the fact that he called you to do that first, to do Pee-wee. Do you ever think about like how lucky that matchmaking was that you didn't have to go through?
Of course, it was a lucky break on so many levels, because it was lucky that I got chosen at all, that my name happened to be both recognizable to him and Paul. Paul knew me through the Forbidden Zone, and Tim knew me through Oingo Boingo. And so Tim was open to the idea and was like, oh, that could be interesting, as opposed to like, oh, no, that's not going to happen. And so that was lucky. And two, it was lucky that I got a film that I was able to like cut loose and do my thing, and that it was low enough under the radar that nobody was like looking, expecting something different, to do what I expected and toss it out and get something professional in. And three, it was lucky that we connected right there in the beginning, as you're saying. I mean, it was just a number of like fateful things coming together at that moment. Now that we're 17 films later, to say that, that was definitely lucky or fateful, I don't know.
Have you ever thought about acting, Danny? Like just on screen, real live action?
Yeah, I know enough to know that I knew early on that I could never be an actor. And I'm the only actor out there that the one thing I got talked into doing ended up on the cutting room floor, and I was grateful. It was Sam Raimi, and it was in a movie called The Gift. And he asked me to come. There's this thing where there's a hillbilly playing a tune in a swamp for Cate Blanchett. And he wanted me to be the hillbilly. So I was in New York at the time. I picked up a violin. I didn't have one with me. Cheap violin. I flew out to Alabama or wherever they were shooting. And what he didn't tell me is that I knew I'd have to get in all this makeup, a beard and all this stuff. But he didn't tell me I had lines. And suddenly it's like, Danny, this is your dialect coach. I go, what the fuck? Lines and dialect. I am so bad. I mean, when it comes to, I don't know how actors ever remember lines in a script. And there's a reason why I could never do like a play, do Broadway. I blank on words. I remember notes. I remember melodies. But I learned this way back with Oingo Boingo. We'd get into rehearsals and we'd start playing Beatle tunes or things that we all knew. And everybody knew all the words and I didn't know any of them. I don't know the words to any songs. I know like three words or one line or something like that. But it's like, that's odd. And then I learned as I got into performing that I can't remember my own words a lot of the times. I hit blank spots frequently. It's like blackouts. It's like, I'm on stage and I'm in the second chorus when the third verse is coming up. And just before it starts, I try to like think, I realize it's not there.
Oof.
And this used to happen to me regularly, to the point where I was an uneasy performer. I was never a natural easy performer. But this moment with Sam Raimi, with the beardian, and all the actors are sitting around looking at me. And the more I'm doing the lines, the worse I'm getting.
Oh.
And this happens to me when I'm doing a promo. Like you try to get me to do like a promo for like a, can you do these lines about the show coming up, do the promo? The more times I do it, the worse I get.
Oh, we have to get the first take then of the one you're going to do for Score the Podcast.
Oh my God, you're not kidding. It's like, I have like a serious, I mean, I have all kinds of mental weirdnesses.
I sometimes wonder when that happens, is it because your brain is so focused on the current project, the future that you're doing, that you can't remember things from before? I just wonder if that, you know, that it's a forgivable in that way, that you're not, you can't, there's not enough room to remember what was before you.
I think it's weirder than that. I think I have miswiring. Seriously, like miswired stuff. I mean, I have things that have been my whole life. I've never been able to learn a second language. I blank out on words. Words go through me like a sieve. I just don't hold on to them, but I can hold on to notes.
Interesting.
I was able to learn how to listen to, freeze in my head, and write down music very easily. It was way easier than I thought, but reading it, I never could do it.
Interesting.
I took lessons later to try to learn how to get my reading abilities up. I just lose it all. And it's like my reading is still, because I taught myself to write without ever reading, I read at the speed that I could write, which is one note at a time. So I can't sit there and read 12 staves simultaneously. So an answer to why I'll never be a conductor, I mean, that's one of many. It'd be a fucking joke, me conducting, because I know the whole score in my head, and I can hear a wrong note when it happens very quickly. But seeing where on the paper, when the question is, I hear an A flat in the clarinet in bar 127, but I hear an A natural coming from the second violins. For me to like look at that and go, whoa, wait, wait, whoa, it takes too long.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't just like go whoop, bang like that. Like our,
so
like
interesting that you can write though the way that you do, that you can see it on paper and write it on paper. But I understand, and it might be, I wonder if it has something to do with the language thing too. There's parts of the brain, maybe.
They're tied together. I mean, I've tried. I really have. And
maybe Uncle Billy got that part of it.
Uncle Billy got it. But writing is tedious. And because I never did scales on an instrument, I never learned to read naturally on an instrument, it never became a natural thing for me. Yeah. I never, you know, there was one point I tried taking violin lessons after I started it, you know, when I came back, and the teacher asked me, where was I on the page? And I couldn't tell him. I'd memorized the lesson easily, but it's like, where are you? He caught on. He says, you're not reading. I go, no, not quite.
We are doing this, this podcast certainly in a very interesting time in all of our culture, and it's affected all of us in different ways. But one way that it has affected our guest, you were going to play Coachella this month.
That's right.
Is it from Boingo to Batman?
I can't tell you exactly because it's still going to happen.
Good. I hope so. In October, we hope.
We hope. But the fact is, yeah, it was, you know, Paul Collette, he tried to get me interested in doing Coachella for a long time, you know, and at a certain point, it's like, okay, a Boingo reunion's not going to happen just because I just have a thing about reunions and I can't do it. And then at a certain point, it was like, we'll do a film thing. Look, you know, Hans did a film thing. And I said, I can't do that without a big orchestra and feel right with myself.
Right.
Because, you know, we've been doing film concerts for 7 years now. And, you know, when I do a film concert, it's a film concert. There's 120 people on stage with the choir and the orchestra. But then he flew me out there and I saw the screens and the whole setup. And I said, wait a minute, there's a way to do this that's mixing everything from my last 40 years together. Bits of film, bits of songs, probably maybe Oingo Boingo songs. And at that same time, I've been working on this new stuff that I had in my mind. And I thought, oh my God, I could premiere this new work.
Wow.
And suddenly it all made sense. And I said, I can do this and I will do it.
That's fantastic. And I can't wait. And I just wondered, I guess, for every performer that was slated for Coachella, was there a moment when it was either, oh shit, I was ready to go, or thank God I get another 6 months? I'm just wondering when you were told, or was it just c'est la vie?
No, it was horrible. I'd put 3 months of intense work into prepping, you know, because unlike almost anybody else out there, I was creating a show from scratch, from nothing.
Right.
It means I had to hire a band. I had to put together arrangements. I had to figure out what it was. Rearrange orchestral music. It was so much work. And we were just at the point where the band was together and we're starting to actually sound good. Mm. And I was getting really excited. I was worried about the fact that, wow, it sure be nice to have a warm-up show somewhere. And, but on the other hand, there's still that part of me, that fuck it, that is like, you know, it's like go out there without a safety net. It's like I still get into a frame of mind that's like, yeah, it makes no sense, but they still can't shoot you for fucking up on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I learned when I went out to do Nightmare Before Christmas songs with the Elfman Burton Show 7 years ago at Albert Hall. I hadn't performed in 18 years. I had stage fright even for the 23 years I was on stage. It had gotten infinitely worse in the 18 years of not performing. And I had to step out at Albert Hall with no warm-up shows ever in front of an audience and sing. I was petrified.
I bet.
And I'll never forget. I was at the stage door and I'm really thinking about just heading out to a pub and hiding out till the show was over. And Helena Bonham Carter was going to do Sally's song. And she's sitting there on the floor and getting into character. And she goes, "Danny, what's going on?" I go, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can walk through these doors." And she says to me, "Danny, come on. Fuck it, right?"
Oh, perfect.
And
she spoke your language there.
Of course. My whole life has been that. And it's like, why would it be different right now? And I just said, fuck it. They still can't shoot you, put you in a firing squad or hang you for fucking up on stage.
Yeah.
And I went out there and I had one of the best performing moments of my life.
That's the best attitude.
It was a reminder once I started that I'd never performed in England, never was there with Oingo Boingo. I had no idea what to expect. We had no rehearsals or run-ups to the show. I had no idea what was going to happen. But once I started, the audience was there for me. And it was so moving. It's like they were my safety net. I didn't need a safety net.
Oh, that's wonderful.
If I'd have fucked up, they'd have forgiven me. I could have stopped the song and started it again. And they would not. And it was just this wonderful thing of remembering what live is all about, what really live is all about, not manufactured live, not semi-live, not well-prepped live, just getting out there without a clue of what's going to happen. Like moments like that are amazing. And that was an amazing moment of.
Are you feeling that for this Coachella show? Because you said you have no run through, so it's kind of that similar situation.
That's where I was like up to 4 weeks ago. It was like this is going to be insane, especially the fact that I'm opening with a tune that nobody's ever heard before. And
great.
I shouldn't even say that. I've already said too much. And
big news going
I was ready.
Out. Oh, it's yeah. just great. By the way,
it was rough. It was rough. It was very rough.
I bet. But the Coachella audience also is so will love you from the first eighth note and be there for you, I'm certain, and will be excited. I can't wait. I was disappointed that I'm a huge Coachella fan, but the last couple of years I haven't been so sure. Danny Elfman at Coachella, not to be missed. And, things first.
It was a hard one.
I bet.
It was a hard one.
They'll come back together. Just before we close it all up,
yeah.
Is there something you're working on between now and Coachella in October? Or did this disrupt your whole year? Don't you have a picture?
Oh, it disrupted my whole year. You know, one of the beauties of Coachella is that I was finishing Saturday night, next Saturday. You know, 3 nights ago was supposed to be the first night.
Right.
And I was getting on a plane on Sunday to get to London to make the dress rehearsal 3 days later for my violin concerto having its London debut with the BBC Orchestra. And of course that canceled too. But the idea of having those two things, Coachella and a violin concerto playing 3 days apart was for me amazing. I said, this is incredible. This is what my life is about.
Yeah.
These contrasts are what I love.
Yeah.
And even right now, I'm doing two things. I'm finishing a commission for the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. It's supposed to play with Proms in August, but of course,
TBD.
We don't know. TBD and or early September, you know, whether things will be back on by then. So 165 young musicians, incredibly talented musicians. I saw them play a year ago. They'd asked me to do a commission and I was like, so I saw like 8 trombones, 4 tubas, you know, it's like, I'm so there. It's like, I am like on board and really talented kids. So I'm in the middle of that. And along with these few new pieces for Coachella that I was doing, I've had this concept in mind for the last year and a half. I call it the big mess. And I don't know what to call it, but it's kind of like chamber punk. It's rock band and a small chamber orchestra playing in a way that I'm just not used to hearing. So I just finished another song for that last night. So I'm doing more of that because even though there were 2 songs going in Coachella, I knew that I wanted to get more together and have something come out at some point.
Do you think
so? That,
any special guests in the plan for Coachella?
Pardon me?
Are there any special guests joining you?
You know, we talked with a few, but now with a new time frame, I'm not even going to mention it because the chances of those happening, it all goes totally back to scratch. If people are on tour or not around, you know, a special guest has to be a lucky thing. If somebody can, they're in town, they can come out and do it. And I have a feeling by the time it comes around, whether it be in October or next April, God knows, who knows, it's not going to be the same. And so no, I can't mention any guests. And I'm not needing guests. You know, if I there are a few guests that if I can get, it would be great. But we had a show down that was going to be really pretty rocking. And so being that you only get an hour in Coachella, it's like already we were like, holy crap, how do I get this thing into 1 hour? Because it's covering a lot of ground.
Well, I kind of love the chamber punk idea. I want to see that. I want to see a cellist in the mosh pit, you know, just mix and match for 2 genres and rock the house.
It's just a thing that, I don't know, it's using strings in a way that I've been wanting to do for a while, aggressively, very aggressive string playing. So they're a kind of part of the band, part of the rhythm section.
Right on.
I wanted to ask you one last question before I let you go. You've had so many great pieces of music. People love your scores. I'm just curious, though, for you personally, is there a score that you're most proud of? Maybe you overcame something or something that was super challenging that changed your outlook on this career that you've had, this amazing career. Is there something that really speaks to you as your proudest score?
No. It's really just a lot of different moments. You know, they're like the hardest, the big mountain was Batman, because that was where I was up against the most resistance and I had to prove myself. But Edward Scissorhands would be like the most, I could do whatever I want and nobody is listening. And, you know, there's no adults in the room. It's just him and I.
Oh,
and that was total freedom. And that, and, you know, along with Nightmare and Beetlejuice, that those are favorites because literally I felt completely free to do whatever I want with Tim. And Tim allowed me such freedom that it was really, now in hindsight, I think some of, you know, my favorite moments naturally are going to be that. But then I have all kinds of others, you know, I really love doing Milk for Gus Van Sant. I mean, the challenge of doing that score, the challenge of doing a movie called Dolores Claiborne, where I'd never done anything like that before. I really got into and loved doing that. There's all these scores where I got to do something that I never did before. And anytime that happens, that becomes like a favorite moment for me.
I know one of mine that is really unorthodox, and we talked about it before you came on. which is Midnight Run.
Midnight Run. Okay, that's another one.
It's just so funky. And so, wait, that's Danny? Because it's like an accordion and a slide guitar and just blues, funk, and it's funny. You make... Oh, it's one of my favorites. It's Dorfler.
And oddly, one of my favorite scores is... People don't believe me when I say this, is Alice in Wonderland. Because I feel like for a certain type of narrative score that's following a classical narrative sense of like melodically taking you through from character to character and everything tying together in a certain way, I think it's my best score in that manner. I was able to put it together in a way that there's all these pieces and they all fit and then play in the end in a way where all the pieces of the puzzle really get to express themselves. And it's one of my favorite themes for my own stuff. So Planet of the Apes, the got all my drums. Holy crap. And forget about that. I never had to do that before. It's like become like an entire drum corps myself. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, 100 voices of Oompa Loompas. It's all me sitting in my basement just doing voice after voice after voice. I love that. Oh, my God. I was like doing those songs was so much fun. So challenges are the things. Girl on a Train, not everybody saw that, but that's a score where it's mostly me playing really bad, nasty electric guitar and synthesizers myself. And I loved it. I'm performing the score. And I just had such a good time doing that. I'm doing anytime you get me doing something that I haven't done before, I'm a happy camper.
Directors out there, remember that. Something he hasn't done before. Come with the challenge. You might get lucky, and you might get what clearly is Danny in Wonderland.
Let me take this time, just because it's a rare opportunity, to thank you for creating the soundtrack of certainly my life and many of our listeners and your fans out there, and also for taking the time to come on the show during this time. We really appreciate it. This has been so great.
You're very welcome. And by the way, I have two more concertos I'll be working on in the next year, Robert.
Oh, good.
Cannot wait for
that. So next year we'll come back. We'll talk about Coachella. We'll talk about concertos. We'll talk about how Billy is doing, because we're going to have a lot of fans writing in to see if he's okay. But Danny, what a treat, really a treat for all of us. I know for all our listeners, but personally for me, just wonderful to hear some of these stories.
The treat is mine. This is so much fun. And look, you know, we're all going crazy right now and I'm bored silly. and to have a lively conversation, which of course, talking with you, you know, is always a pleasure talking with somebody who understands exactly what I do. It's not a mystery. I don't have to kind of explain myself to you in terms of what it is. You're interested in how things happen and what way, but I don't have to like educate you. You know as much or more than I'll ever know about music. And so that's a pleasure for me. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
It is our pleasure.
Thank you so much. And a reminder to our listeners to follow us. There's a number of ways: Instagram, Score Movie, Twitter at Score the Podcast, Facebook, Score a Film Music Documentary, and shoot us your questions, Score the Mailbox at epiclef.com, and stick around after the show. We're going to play you a little clip from Spitfire Audio so you can elevate your music. Robert, take it away.
Hey, Danny Elfman, what a treat. Our kickoff episode for season 3, just a beautiful way to start our new season. We wish everyone great health coming up, and a big thank you to Maestro Elfman. We'll see you next time.
Much love.
Thank you, Danny.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody.
Hey, Score listeners, we're so grateful for the support of Spitfire Audio. They, of course, collaborate with composers like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what it sounds like.
And as an exclusive to our Score the Podcast listeners, Spitfire is offering 20% off your first order. That's good on over 50 of their libraries that will elevate your music.
It's exclusive to Score the Podcast listeners. Just go to spitfireaudio.com and enter that promo code SCORE2020 so they know we sent you. And check it out. Here's a little clip from the Bernard Herrmann Toolkit so you can elevate your music. Again, use that promo code SCORE2020 to get 20% off your first order. Thanks for listening to Score the Podcast. We will see you next week on the show.
Right on.